Yeah, thanks, Luca. And of course, thank you very much for the invitation. It's always a great pleasure to be able to reconnect with the people at the Perimeter Institute and Canada. So I hope people can hear me okay, but I'm assuming you'll give me a shout if there's any issues. So this is kind of a topic that I haven't really talked about before very much because it's kind of very recent work and it's kind of something that I've only got into very recently. But I was told that this was kind of what you were mostly interested in hearing about. So these are kind of different ways that I will explore here in this talk, in which the metric signature can change in a way that's not often discussed in the literature, and in particular ways that this could be connected to also a change in the cosmological constant and therefore actually have physical implications, rather than just being something to do with sort of pure conventions. And I will hopefully clarify this in a little bit. So the paper that we put out very recently with some of these ideas is with Bruno Alexandre and João Magejo, who are both at Imperial College in London. So this is the recent paper here. And we're exploring kind of different ways of getting these kind of transitions in that paper. One thing that I personally find very nice as a possible motivation for these things, already at the classical level, is the Plebanski formalism for gravity, which of course many of us are familiar with, also from the perspective of spin foam models and things like that. And so here I also want to talk a little bit about these two papers with Elliot Nash, who is also at Sheffield. Where we looked specifically at the Plebanski formalism and the implications for cosmology of using that formulation of gravity, and it will hopefully connect in a way that makes sense to you to this first part. So just to give you some introduction and some motivation, what I'm actually talking about here. So most of what I will say is actually in the classical theory. So purely classical gravity, although it's motivated perhaps by quantum gravity, most of it will be classical. So of course, in classical general relativity, we're interested in Lorentzian metrics, and we can fix the signature, the overall signature of the metric. And of course, you all know that there's basically two possible conventions for this. We can fix the signature to be minus plus 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 if we're interested in four dimensions, or we can do plus, minus, minus, minus. And these are often called the East Coast convention or the West Coast convention. Now, of course, people might disagree on what convention they prefer. I think sort of many people have gravitated towards the East Coast convention over the years. But it's clear that sort of in the classical level, at the classical level, you can do any calculation you want and extract any kind of physically meaningful observable statement in either of these conventions, right? This is really just a pure convention. Of course, you have to be careful when you translate expressions from one convention to another. When you're picking up your favorite textbook on GR, you have to be careful that it uses the convention that you want to use yourself. But it clearly is just a convention, right? There's no physics in this choice at the classical level. So here I want to explore the possibility that in fact you can have a transition during sort of within the same space-time. So you can have a space-time which kind of in some regions will have the East Coast convention and some other regions will have the West Coast convention. Now, why would you consider such a thing? So I think a main motivation, which I will also explore in the next few slides, is from the quantum theory. So you might want to define, for example, path integral, and there you might want to integrate over all the possible Lorentzian metrics defined with respect to a certain convention, so for example, East Coast convention. But then you want to evaluate this path integral approximately in a kind of a semi-classical or saddle point approximation. And we know from many examples, including the most famous ones, that these saddle points tend to be complex, right? So even if you start with a theory of real Lorentzian metrics in a certain signature, then the saddle points might have the opposite signature. So in particular, you might have the case where the saddle point is described by a Lorentzian solution, but of the opposite signature that you started with. Okay, so that's a nice motivation for looking at this already at the classical level. A different motivation, which I already mentioned, which I will talk about later, comes in particular from the Plebanski formalism in this chiral version. of the Plobansky formalism for classical gravity, where you don't have a metric. So the metric, in a sense, is a derived quantity. So you have two forms, which, locally you can think of as some kind of area element, which kind of induce the metric in when you solve certain constraints, but you don't have the metric to begin with. And so in particular, I will argue that you cannot even fix the signature of this effective metric, even if you want to. So in that case, you're kind of forced to looking at these scenarios where you have two possible or multiple possible signatures emerging in the same solution. So I just want to show you this quantum example because I think it's quite interesting and already illustrates the main points, perhaps, that I will also be discussing later. So this is the example that I'm familiar with, which is perhaps one of the more well-known ones. So this is a calculation in quantum cosmology in the context of this kind of traditional no boundary proposal. So this is a paper by Hartle and Hertog from 2012. So what you do here in the simplest setting is you work in mini superspace. So you assume your metric is FRW. And in this particular case, you're interested in spherical slices. So positively curved sort of hypersurfaces at fixed time. And the metric would then take this form. So this is kind of this ansatz that you make. And here you have the Laplace function squared and the scale factor squared. And here the signs are chosen such that this is a Euclidean metric, right? So if these are real valued Laplace and scale factor, then you will get a positive definite metric. But that's just the starting point. As I already said, sort of once you start looking at saddle point solutions, you will naturally also encounter complex trajectories here. But if you start with this Euclidean setting, then you can define your action for gravity. And already here, there's some conventions and some possible sign choices that come in. So this is the traditional convention in this Euclidean quantum gravity program, where here you fix the cosmological constant to be positive and you reduce the Einstein-Hilbert action to this mini superspace model with certain sign conventions. So that's the action that you have at this level, which you then use to define your path integral, right? And then you would be interested in some kind of approximate evaluation of this path integral using saddle points, which you can think of as classical solutions to the classical equations of motion extended to complex solutions, right? So once you allow the sort of complexified classical solutions, then these would typically represent your saddle points. Here, of course, the Laplace is a pure gauge choice. So by changing the Laplace, you will change the time coordinate you're using. So for example, you can just pick n equal to 1. And then you can show, as you would expect, that the unique classical solution is sphere, right? This is exactly what you expect. So this is a four-dimensional sphere foliated by three-dimensional spheres, right? And so the scale factor in this sense would be a sine. So it go from zero to the maximum and back to zero. Okay. So what you're now typically interested in is a saddle point solution that starts from this no boundary condition in the past, which you can sort of think of as being at the south pole of the sphere. And then in the far future, you want a Lorentzian solution. So you want Lorentzian de Sitter space. And one way of representing this saddle point is by starting in this Euclidean regime that you have here. So looking at this kind of sphere solution, going from the south pole to the equator in this Euclidean regime, and then going into a Lorentzian regime. And the Lorentzian regime is characterized by sort of tau going parallel to the imaginary axis, right? And this is something you can see from here. So if n is equal to 1, right, this is not there. So here I just have d tau squared. So then if tau d tau becomes imaginary, this is a way of getting the minus sign, and then I get a Lorentzian solution. Okay. So this is all well known since sort of the 1980s. And here this is this representation on the left-hand side. So maybe this is a bit difficult to see, but this is supposed to be the real part of tau. This is supposed to be the imaginary part of tau because I fixed the gauge. So tau is now just kind of proper time. And so in this typical representation of the saddle point, here you start going along the real axis, and then eventually you go along the parallel to the imaginary axis, and here you connect to some kind of final boundary condition. Okay, and so this would be this kind of half of the sphere glued to the sitter space. Now, what Hartle and Hertog say in this paper is that you can equivalently represent the same saddle point solution by basically changing this contour in the complex plane. And this is something you're allowed to do because in the end, your action is kind of an analytic function. So it allows these kind of deformations. So the value of the action will not change. And so you are entitled to thinking of this saddle point in this equivalent way here, which is on the right, where you first go along the imaginary axis, then you go parallel to the real axis, and then you go parallel to the imaginary axis. Of course, the boundary values here are fixed, so they are unchanged, but the way in which you connect them is different, okay? And so what you then observe is that here now, if you start by going along the imaginary axis, so again, if you go back to this example here, so n is equal to 1, as I said, so this part becomes negative, and then a of tau, right, if you make tau imaginary, this turns from sine into I times sinh, and so eventually the metric you will find is this, okay? So this is the metric that describes this first part of this new representation of the same saddle point, okay? Now, what you see here is that the signs are now all negative. So this is still what you might call a Euclidean metric or Riemannian metric, but the signature is now negative definite. And what's maybe more confusing even is that this is now an anti-de Sitter metric. So if you were to flip the signs here, this would just be a representation of what you might call hyperbolic space, right? Just Riemannian hyperbolic space with negative Ricci scalar. And here's called Euclidean ADS. And this is then used to connect to ADS CFD in a way that I will not talk about here, but this seems very puzzling, right? So by kind of making these kind of complex deformations here, you have ended up with this metric, which is now negative definite, but also is an ADS solution, not a de Sitter solution, even though your theory has positive lambda, okay? So this, when you first see it, looks very puzzling, okay? So what's going on here? So this is one way of thinking about it, which I think is perhaps the most intuitive way of seeing what is happening. So these saddle point solutions must be solutions to the Einstein equations, from what I said. And because this is just a very simple theory, only with lambda, no matter, and so on, these are the Einstein equations, okay, with lambda. And now we're supposed to think of the metric in general as complex. Now, if we're starting with a particular solution to this theory and we are flipping the overall signature, which is basically what happened here, right? You ended up with this negative definite signature. So in this example, you go from plus, 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 plus to minus, 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 minus. The metric, you can think of the metric as sort of flipping signatures, so just being multiplied by minus one overall. But the Riemann tensor does not change under this transformation. And so in particular, also the Ricci tensor will not change under this transformation. So if you look at what this does to the Einstein equations, this is a relatively trivial observation. You see that basically changing this overall signature is the same as changing lambda to minus lambda, right? So in a sense, this is what's happening here. So you have this theory which has positive lambda to begin with, and it has kind of positive definite metrics that are spheres, but then it also has negative definite metrics that are sort of hyperbolic space. So from this point of view, you might then argue that GR with positive lambda also contains anti-de Sitter solutions. Okay, so this is a initially puzzling statement, but once you look at it from this perspective, you can see where it comes from. Okay. So this, of course, now here, this was at the level of saddle points, but this was then pushed further. There's another paper with Stephen Hawking, where they actually looked at the full kind of quantum solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in a theory with negative lambda to show that these also contain, in this sense, de Sitter-like solutions that are semi-classical and exponentially expanding. So this is this paper you might have seen, which is called Inflation with Negative Lambda. Oh, inflation from negative lambda, I think, which I actually reviewed this paper in a group meeting at the Perimeter in 2012. I think there's a question.
Stefan, I have a question. So usually complex continuation, I do it with a lapse function and not with the tau parameter. Mm-hmm. But here it seems to be important, but lapse function would be also kind of determined in the saddle point equation. But here you have to choose the tau parameter, the time parameter, no? To not to change the saddle point.
Right. So I see what you're saying. I mean, this is the way it was in which this is usually presented in the literature in many of these papers. Of course, you have to fix the gauge when you do the path integral, right? You have to somehow fix the lapse to make the path integral well defined.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess you're asking, would I get the same representation if I make a different lapse choice? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I'm asking because here it's always discussed as an analytical continuation for the time parameter. Can one also understand it as an analytical continuation in the lapse parameter? Yeah, I guess one has to choose a different choice of gauge from the standard one. That is.
Yeah, I think you have to be a bit careful. So, I mean, say if I'm a cosmologist, I want to do this in conformal time, right? So I choose n equal to a. I'm sure the same calculation goes through. And I would believe that I would still be able to show something similar to this. So if n is equal to a, then a going imaginary would mean that all the signs flip at the same time. But yeah, one certainly has to redo the calculation and check exactly what's happening. So I haven't really looked at this. This is just from the literature, and I haven't looked at this in a different gauge. But it's true that from a certain point of view, thinking of n being imaginary or a being imaginary rather than some coordinate seems much more meaningful because, of course, we're integrating over the fields. We're not integrating over coordinates.
Yeah, but in that case, I'm wondering because that's what n and a is should be fixed by the saddle point equation. So if it's a bit arbitrariness, is it a gauge arbitrary? Is it some gauge choice which one does?
That's a good question. Potentially, yeah. I don't know. I haven't thought about this. So I guess you're asking whether the signature itself is somehow gauge dependent, right? That's what you're asking. I mean, that would certainly be puzzling if that was the case, but I mean, given that you allow everything to be complex, these things are just, you know, generally, so this section here, for example, is just complex. So here you're picking out certain parts that have a certain representation for a while as Euclidean and then become fully complex.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be that whether this even exists as a Euclidean part before it becomes completely complex, that could also depend on your choice of lapse. Yeah, I think that's certainly conceivable,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't thought about this in detail.
Okay, thanks.
So I also had a question. On the next slide, when you mentioned this change of signature can be thought of as a change of cosmological constant sign, I mean, this is true for the vacuum Einstein equations, but I guess this wouldn't be true in the presence of fields or...
Yeah, sure. So that's, of course, true. So this is a very simple scenario here where you don't have any other matter fields. Of course, then, yeah, sure. So you could have equivalent discussions for a more complicated theory. So if I'm adding a team mu nu, which comes from some matter fields, which also in some sense will indirectly depend on the metric, then I could look at, you know, different components of the stress energy and how they transform under this transformation, g goes to minus g. And I think in general, that will depend on how you actually write down your matter action. So right, in that sense, yeah, you'd have to look at in more detail, say if you have scalar fields or perfect fluids or things like that.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Good. Great. So this example basically already contains the main one of the main ideas in a sense, which is the fact that somehow this signature of lambda is directly connected to the signature of the metric, and so depending on how you define your theory, you will then have these effects where effectively, you know, flipping the signature looks like you're changing lambda to minus lambda. In a sense, that is already the main point, but there's different ways in which you can do this and think about this. So this is what we did with Joe and with Joao. So we were trying to do this a bit more kind of systematically. So this is now purely classical. There's no longer a quantum motivation here. This is just a classical construction where you try and basically put all the different signature choices together in one theory. In a sense, that's what you're trying to do. So well, normally, again, you would only work with one particular signature. So for example, you would work with Lorentzian minus plus plus plus. This is the standard choice. And this would be one way of defining the Einstein-Hilbert action, which I guess for me is the kind of canonical choice in terms of the signs here in front of the different terms, even though, of course, different conventions exist. Already when you go to Euclidean signature, people might disagree on how they would like to define the action. So already there are different conventions. And basically the point we're making here is that there's also this overall signature flip, and you have to think about your conventions for defining the action. So the way of parameterizing the metric signature overall in the general case is basically this. So this S can be plus or minus one. So then plus one would be Euclidean, minus one would be Lorentzian. And there's also this overall sigma. So if sigma is minus one, then in a sense you have this overall flip. And sigma, again, can only be plus or minus one, of course. So in a sense, then, when you extend the definition of the action to this more general case, you have to somehow agree on where you put your S and sigma factors. And this, to some extent, is just a convention. So for us, the, in a sense, most natural or simplest way of setting these conventions is this. So here, this is the kind of obvious thing where you just replace minus g by absolute value of g, because this can be positive, metric determinant can be positive or negative. And then we put a sigma here in front of the Ricci scalar. The main reason for doing that is then if you now look at the Einstein equations for this more general definition, the sigma appears in the Einstein equations. So in a sense, you have separated the what I would call the physical lambda from this kind of somewhat artificial effect, perhaps, of signature flip in lambda that is related to the metric signature, right? So if your Einstein equation is defined in this way, now if I, you know, do the same thing that I talked about before, and I said I send g to minus g, then of course I would also have to change the sigma, so these two things would cancel, right? So the value of this lambda here really represents, in some sense, the physical lambda. What I mean by that is that, yeah, De Sitter solutions will always have positive lambda, anti-De Sitter solutions will always have negative lambda, right? So that, in a way, is a way of separating out this kind of signature dependence effect here by just changing your Einstein-Hilbert action. Okay, but there are other ways of doing this. Now, most of what I'm looking at is still mini-superspace, so let's do the same thing, go to FRW. So here we have slightly different conventions in our paper, but basically we're looking at two different ways of getting to this mini superspace model. So here's the general parameterization of the metric. Okay, so this Hij, this is just your fiducial metric, which has constant curvature. We are leaving this S explicitly out front. So the Euclidean and Lorentzian theories now are kind of separated explicitly by this S factor here in front. And then there's basically two ways of taking care of this overall flip of the sigma factor. So one way of doing it is basically just making it explicit. So you leave the sigma here. So sigma can again be plus one or minus one. And then you have n squared or a squared, and these would then be assumed to be positive. So you would assume that a squared is positive and n squared is positive, as you would normally expect perhaps in the classical theory. Or you can basically merge this sigma and, you know, the positive definite n squared and a squared into one variable, which, you know, in the paper we've decided to call this n tilde squared and a tilde squared. And these can now be negative as well. Okay, so even though this is a square, you would allow for solutions where these things become negative, which would basically then represent the signature flip, right? So this is the way of basically putting the positive definite quantity together with the sign into one variable that can vary over the real line, which in some sense you might find more economical as a parameterization. So now once you have set these conventions, okay, you can obviously reduce your action to mini superspace. So you have to calculate the Ricci scalar. You have to cancel total derivatives by adding the Gibbons Hawking York boundary term, which I won't really show you here in detail. And then there's a few more kind of subtle issues here. So perhaps the most non-trivial one is what happens to this kind of square root of absolute value of the metric determinant. So here also you have to make some choices of how to represent this square root in terms of the variables n and a, for example, in this parameterization. And the standard one that people do in the literature is just to replace this by n a cubed, so without any absolute values here, which would then give you this nice property that your action is analytic and so on. And so you can then derive the mini superspace action. So here you would get the one you perhaps expect. So this S parameter now appears explicitly here, which is maybe exactly what you expect, right? Because these are the time derivatives. So in a sense, this should depend on whether it's Euclidean or Lorentzian. And if you write everything in these tilde variables, now what you observe is that, again, you see this explicit dependence on the metric signature. So what comes in here when you write everything in terms of these tilde variables is here the sine of a tilde squared appears explicitly. So, which is of course the remnant of this sigma parameter, right? So the sigma parameter now gets translated into the sine of a tilde squared. And so this kind of, I could have started here with say a positive lambda, which again, from this argument was supposed to be the physical lambda. So I only want to have De Sitter solutions, no anti-De Sitter solutions. So I put this to positive value. But then what appears here in the action is actually the product of this lambda with the sine of a tilde squared. Okay, and that's in a sense the kind of thing we saw before, right? Which is this kind of signature dependent lambda. So in a sense, that is kind of the most straightforward definition in this setting, is to keep what we then call lambda tilde, of course. So lambda tilde is now this combination of the physical lambda and this signature parameter. And if you keep that fixed, then in terms of this model here, this is the simplest form of the dynamics. Okay. So maybe it's still a bit puzzling, even after all this discussion, how lambda can possibly make a transition. Because of course, normally we have the Bianchi identities, and the Bianchi identities tell us that lambda cannot be made a function of space and time. So that's just a simple argument here. So again, in these conventions that I want to use here, where I'm separating the physical lambda from the signature parameter, of course, you can take the Bianchi identities into account. You take a covariant derivative on both sides, and you would get this statement here that this product of sigma and lambda has to be a constant. But of course, the Bianchi identities will not be obviously applicable when your metric changes signature, because it becomes degenerate, right? This is kind of, you will have some kind of surface of this transition where the metric will not be invertible. And so it's not clear how to define the Bianchi identities on that surface. So in principle, that seems to give you the freedom of replacing lambda by some general function of the signature parameters. So in the most general scenario, you might think of lambda as an arbitrary function of both sigma and S. So it could change when you go from Euclidean to Lorentzian, but also when you do this overall flip. In mini superspace, of course, there's also an analog of this Bianchi identity, which is a consistency condition of the sort of conservation in time of the Hamiltonian constraint. And here the consistency condition takes this form. So that kind of contains the same information here, just in this mini superspace example, which is basically to say that if a squared is not zero, then sigma times lambda must be a constant in time. But of course, if a squared goes to zero, then in principle, you can have a jump here, right? In any case, the simplest scenario, again, is the one where this combination, this product of sigma times the physical lambda is just a constant everywhere, right? And that's kind of the case I showed you in the beginning in this quantum cosmology example, right? So where, in a sense, you have this, direct relation between the overall metric signature and the sign of the cosmological constant, such that when you make this transition, lambda would have to flip. the physical lambda would have to flip. I hope that's not too confusing. But what I wanted to kind of get across here is that in principle, there are choices here. And when you make these signature transitions, you do have the freedom to, in principle, change lambda. And in this minimalistic setting, you would just get an overall sign change. Now you can go to the Hamiltonian setting. This is perhaps what you'd like to do. So then you have to get a variable that's canonically conjugate to this a tilde. Or in fact, the simplest form is obtained if you take a tilde squared as your canonical variable. This is some kind of area element, which is canonically conjugate to the connection. And people working on LQG and Einstein-Cartan and so on are very familiar with this. So in this setting, then you have this connection variable b tilde, which is, as you can see here, forms a kind of a canonical pair with this variable a tilde squared. And again, you should now think of a tilde squared as something that can be positive or negative from this argument that I gave you before. This is quite important. So this is no longer constrained to be positive definite, but it can be negative as well when you have the signature flip. And here I've just redefined the Lagrange multiplier for convenience. So I don't have to worry anymore what happens to n tilde and a tilde. But here you can see now this Hamiltonian constraint again, in a sense, explicitly depends on this sign factor. Okay, so the simplest application, so maybe this is showing you a little bit more what this can do for you, is a transition between de Sitter and anti-de Sitter space. Okay, so again, you have to fix your conventions. So here, again, the simplest setting is the one where this lambda tilde is fixed. So that's just a constant, which you can choose to be positive. Of course, it doesn't really matter whether it's positive or negative, because you'll always get de Sitter and anti-de Sitter solutions. But let's fix it to be positive. And let's fix negative, s equal to minus one, which is Lorentzian signature, because that's obviously most interesting for the universe. And then you can derive the solution. Very easy to write it down in a particular gauge. So here I'm not fixing the lapse equal to one, but this combination, basically n tilde a tilde is fixed to one. That's an even simpler gauge to work in. And then you have these solutions, right? So this a tilde squared is basically just quadratic in time plus some constant, and the connection is just linear in t. Okay. So now this k is your standard spatial curvature parameter. If you choose that to be negative, then of course you can see that you will get a solution of this type. So these are now negatively curved kind of spatial hypersurfaces. Here you will have the Sitter space. The scale factor eventually will go to zero, as you know from your cosmology textbook. And then when it turns negative, when a tilde squared becomes negative, in fact, here you have effectively an anti-de Sitter solution. Right, by this argument here, that of course the physical lambda will flip sign when a tilde squared becomes negative, and so you necessarily have a de Sitter region, an anti de Sitter region, and another de Sitter region kind of glued together. And what's interesting here perhaps is that there's really no singularities in these solutions, right? This is like a very, very simple smooth differentiable solution in terms of the metric. And it doesn't have any curvature singularities. So even the Ricci tensor, for example, you could calculate that. That would be completely smooth even across this transition, right? The only thing that changes, again, is the interpretation in some sense of the Ricci tensor in terms of de Sitter or anti-de Sitter by this kind of signature flip argument that I gave you before. I hope that makes sense. I mean, please do ask if there's questions for this. But I mean, this is just a simple example, in a sense, that shows you what this kind of slight extension of GR can in a sense, do for you, right? So in standard GR, you would have to stop here. You would basically say the foliation kind of breaks down. This is de Sitter space, but you know, this negatively curved hypersurfaces don't give you a full foliation of the whole solution. But here you can basically just extend that. And you can basically glue that to an anti-de Sitter solution and then to another de Sitter solution, which you might find interesting for a possible cosmology in this simple setting.
Yeah, I have a question. Because yes. K usually determines whether it's anti-de Sitter or de Sitter, no? Or
In which
it's
sense?
A spatial curvature.
Yes, that's right.
No, it's a spatial curvature. So with mm-hmm. if you fix k equal to -1,
mm-hmm. yes,
you say you can have also a Disitter solution.
Yeah, you can. So this is just a standard Lorentzian okay, Disitter solution that you know from the textbooks. Yeah, this is a Lorentzian Disitter solution with negative k, and the scale factor uh-huh. is basically a cinch. So eventually it goes to zero. It has a zero, which is a uh-huh. you know coordinate singularity, if you wish. And here on the uh-huh. other side, you have a negative k foliation for anti-Disitter, but with a metric that now has the opposite overall signature. So it goes to plus, minus, minus, minus suddenly.
Uh-huh.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
So this example only works with negative k, of course. If k is positive or zero, then you will not have this transition. You will just have Disitter for all times.
Yeah.
Okay. So I wanted to change tack a little bit and well, stay in the same discussion, but give you a different motivation, which is from this Karel Plebanski formulation of gravity, which depending on your background, you may or may not be familiar with. So I want to just review this very briefly here. This is a possible way of thinking about gravity, which is quite old, actually. Was developed in the 70s, but then you know, worked on by many people and important in particular in the construction of spinform models. So here the fundamental variables for gravity are quite different. So you have a complex formulation and you have a connection, which is an SU2 connection, which in general is complex. And then the kind of the metric information is encoded in these two forms, which are self-dual in a certain sense. So this is a triplet of two forms, which are usually denoted sigma I. And so the action can be defined in this way. So here you have these two forms. Here you have the curvature two form of this connection. You also need a matrix field. So this is a symmetric matrix, Mij. And the trace of M is constrained by this last term, right? You see that if you vary with respect to this new field, then you will get a constraint on the trace, which in a sense encodes the cosmological constant in this setting. So this lambda tilde is usually seen as a fixed parameter. And in general, as I said, this is complex, but if you restrict the solutions by imposing certain reality conditions, you can get Lorentzian or Euclidean solutions. Here's just an overall factor here, which makes sure that the action is real for both of those cases. But this is something you can certainly ignore if you're not too familiar with this. So the point is that, from this general complex theory, so this is in a sense the complex GR formulation already at the classical level, but you can restrict to certain solutions which are Lorentzian or Euclidean, which you will do by certain reality conditions. Now, the point here, the important point, is that the metric is not a fundamental variable. And you have a constraint, which is called the simplicity constraint, which comes from variation with respect to this matrix M, right? You can see that you will obtain this constraint, basically sigma, which sigma is related to this new field. And you can look at the possible solutions to this constraint. And this is explained in full detail, for example, in the textbook by Kirill Krasnov, which was published a few years ago. The point is that now you can look at this separately in this Lorentzian regime or this Euclidean regime. The point is that there will be multiple solution sectors. So the possible solutions split into different sectors in terms of whether you can write these two forms as coming from a tetrad. Right. So what you would like to see is that there's a set of one forms that form a tetrad such that these two forms can be written as certain wedge products of these tetrad one forms. This is what you would like to have. What you actually get is basically that if this constraint is satisfied, these sigmas come from a tetrad, but the tetrad is not guaranteed to be real. In fact, you can have these global phase factors. So in the Lorentzian theory, you can show that the tetrad is real up to one of these kind of global factors here, which are sort of just phases. But even in the Euclidean setting, where the sigmas are real, everything is real, the tetra that you reconstruct is not necessarily real. So in this case, the tetrad is either real or purely imaginary. Okay. And then from this tetrad, you can define a metric, which is called the Obanke metric. And basically the point I wanted to make here is that the signature of this metric cannot be fixed. You will always get both possible cases. So in the Lorentzian setting, you'll get this minus plus 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 or plus minus minus minus. Even in the Euclidean setting, where you might think that you have to be positive definite, that is not true, because the tetrad can have this I factor. And in that case, you would have a negative definite metric. So this is your of gravity, which, you know, in a sense, locally is indistinguishable from sort of the metric Einstein-Hilbert formulation. You would still have these multiple solution sectors that you have to take into account. And in particular, your solution can make a transition along the lines of the metric framework. Okay. So this is something I kind of already said, which is sort of this trace constraint here. So this gives you a constraint on the trace of this M matrix. This encodes effectively the trace part of the Einstein-Hilbert, of the Einstein equations in terms of this reconstructed metric. And the way I'm writing it here in terms of this lambda tilde already shows you that the meaning of this parameter is now, again, this signature-dependent lambda, right? And in fact, it seems extremely difficult in this setting to change that. I mean, I wouldn't know how to extract the signature dependence from this parameter, given that I don't know what the signature is until I've solved the simplicity constraint. So in this framework where there is no metric really to start with, the metric is a derived concept, the signature dependence seems somehow absolutely inevitable. Okay, so we studied this theory with Elliot in a couple of papers, and we also looked at cosmological models like Bianchi models and so on. So here I just want to look at the FRW model. What you do here is you can get rid of the sigma fields by kind of solving for the equation of motion for the sigmas and basically substituting that back in. You get an action like this, which now only contains the connection and kind of this matrix field. And then you can reduce all of that to the homogeneous tropic case and do your, you know, suitable variable redefinitions. You end up basically with this mini superspace model. Okay. So here, just to explain the notation, the C is a connection variable. So this is just your, you know, you have this SU2 connection, but because it's homogeneous and isotropic, it's determined by just a single function, C of T, which is this function here. And P is the conjugate variable to C, which is derived from this matrix M, okay? So by some suitable canonical transformation. So that's just this canonical part here, which tells you that these two variables are canonically conjugate. And then from this part here, you basically get a constraint, right? Just by reducing this to FRW, you get the Lagrange multiplier, which we call lambda bar. And then this is your constraint here. Okay, so again, K will be your spatial curvature parameter. S is your signature parameter. C is the connection and P is this conjugate variable. Okay, and so this P variable will now play the role of what I called A tilde squared before. In particular, this P has no reason to be positive, right? There's no constraint on the sign of this variable. This is just a suitable notation here to make lambda dimensionless. So you multiply your lambda tilde by basically the Planck area and you get something dimensionless. That's not something to worry about too much, but you see now this action doesn't contain any dimensionful parameters anymore. So that in that sense, that's quite nice. And these C and P variables are exactly the ones that you might be familiar with from loop quantum gravity and loop quantum cosmology in particular, right? So this would encode the SU2 connection and P would basically come from the densitized triad. The point I want to make here is that this mini superspace model is completely equivalent to the one I showed you before. So it's completely equivalent to this model here. After some basically trivial rescaling of these variables by some constants. And so you can basically at this mini superspace level, the Plobansky formalism would give you this signature dependent reduction of the Einstein-Hilbert action. So that's another way of thinking about it. And you can show this, you can verify this explicitly by writing down this Obanke metric, right? So in the mini superspace, this is quite easy. Your simplicity constraints are already satisfied and you can derive the tetrad and so on. And then you can write down the metric and it will be of this form here. So you see this P variable, you see that quite explicitly now, basically plays the role. You can see this here. It appears like a square of the scale factor, but with this possible sign in front, because p can also be negative. And then here, this lambda bar parameter is effectively your Laplace function. But again, a rescaled Laplace function, because p also appears here. And if you're familiar with these old kind of mini superspace discussions, the no boundary proposal, this is in fact a very popular parametrization of the FRW metric, which to my knowledge was introduced by Halliwell in the late 80s, where basically you introduce a variable that's not the scale factor, but the square of the scale factor. And you rescale your Laplace in this way. And this simplifies the definition of the mini superspace action dramatically. And this was also used by Lehner's, Turok, and so on in all of their works. So this is very familiar from the literature, but of course there, typically if you start from a metric, you seem to have this problem that sort of this p variable should really be positive, right? And you would like to restrict it to be positive. But in this viewpoint here now, there's no reason why this should be positive. And in fact, the point I want to make here is that your quantum theory is much simpler if p is not restricted to be positive. So if p can be positive or negative, in a sense, you can integrate out this variable p completely. Effectively at the classical level, this is just by solving for this constraint and plugging it back in. But I'll show you in the next slide that this is also a proper quantum calculation, which is quite trivial. And then the Lagrangian is a total derivative, right? So you can immediately write the action as a pure boundary term in terms of this connection variable. That's really quite interesting, right? So you have this kind of gravitational action in mini superspace, which is now equal to something only evaluated at the final time and the initial time in terms of this connection variable. And that's certainly something that I hadn't seen before. So you would, of course, expect in this mini superspace model that there's no local degrees of freedom, right? So you can think about that in the metric or in the connection formalism. That doesn't really make a difference, but you basically have one canonical pair, which is the C and P variables, and you have one constraint, right? So you wouldn't expect any local degrees of freedom left. But here, this is particularly explicit in the sense that sort of there are no field equations anymore, right? Because it's really just a boundary term. You can get the same result, unsurprisingly, if you take the pure connection theory that Krasnov wrote down, which is basically obtained if you start here by also integrating out this M field and so on until you're only left with something that only depends on the connection, and then reducing that to mini superspace. So if you follow that procedure, you will also end up with the same result. And so, of course, the quantum theory now of this theory is particularly trivial because the action really just depends on the boundary values, right? It doesn't depend at all on the intermediate trajectory of this connection. So this is something you can also see here if you want to calculate the path integral. So say we are interested in our usual kind of two-point function, but we're fixing the connection on the boundary. So we have some initial and final value for the connection rather than for the metric. Then you can write down this path integral. You have to fix the gauge. So here there's this popular gauge fixing where lambda bar is equal to constant. Again, I'm restricting to Lorentzian. And then what you would like to evaluate is the following path integral, right? You still have to integrate over these C and P fields. And here I'm just substituting in the mini superspace action that I showed you here. And of course, you can see immediately how to do this, right? So the P integral can be done because it's just linear in P. And this will tell you that basically C dot is equal to lambda bar. Lambda bar is just a constant. So that tells you that C is linear in time. And then you can integrate over C and you end up with this. And there's a single delta function here, which basically relates this lambda to the initial and final values of the connection, which you could then use to integrate over lambda bar, and you end up with this answer. So this, in a sense, is an honest path integral calculation, if you wish, of this result that you could, in a sense, already see at the classical level here, which is that this action is a pure boundary term. So that's, of course, what you get here. Okay, and sort of this result for the two-point function, that was well known in the literature, but this kind of the fact that you can observe it in terms of a classical action, that's a pure boundary term, that was as far as we know not really discussed before. So this two-point function, you can then view that in terms of the Chern-Simon state or the Kodama state, if you wish. This boundary term, if you wish, is just the Chern-Simons functional evaluated on mini superspace. And if you want to go back to the Hartle-Hawking or Wilenkin state in terms of the metric, for example, Joao has discussed a few years ago that you can do some kind of formal Fourier transform to get back to these metric-dependent states. The point I wanted to make here that is that all of this relies on the fact that this p variable can be negative, right? So the fact that you can just integrate out p and get this delta function, this only works if p goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. So the quantum theory is really simplified a lot by allowing these signature dependent, the signature transitions in the metric, as I described. Okay. So I wanted to mention a few more points, but I'm kind of close to the end now. So one thing I always like discussing is unimodular gravity. So there, of course, situation is quite different for the cosmological constant in the sense that you think of lambda as arising from an integration constant, right? And usual argument is basically the one spelled out here. So in this setting, you fix the volume form, right? So you don't allow arbitrary coordinate transformations, but you basically fix this metric determinant by hand to be equal to some given kind of volume form. Often people set this equal to one, but you can be more general. And then if you do that, you only have the trace three Einstein equations that are consistent with this reduced gauge symmetry. So from this initially, you would say that the Ricci scalar cannot be determined, but then you have the Bianchi identities, right? So wherever the Einstein equations are well-defined, you can take the Bianchi identity into account, and that will tell you that R is in fact equal to a constant, which then in a sense fixes the effective lambda as an integration constant. So here, in a sense, the question of whether there are these signature transitions, in a sense, depends on what you put in here for the volume form, right? Because if you want the metric to change signature, as I said, in between, you must have some kind of degenerate metric. So you must have a surface or kind of a region where the metric determinant goes to zero. And here, of course, that's only allowed, in a sense, if you put that in by hand, which you might find a bit arbitrary, but you can certainly do that in this setting. You can say that I'm using a volume form here, which has some zeros. And if you do that, then of course, across that surface, again, the Ricci scalar could change. And so the effective lambda could also change again. But here, this is kind of your input. There's a way of thinking about unimodular gravity, which I also like very much, which is this parameterized formulation that Enno and Teitelbaum first wrote down. So in this setting, you kind of restore the full diffeomorphism symmetry by adding some extra fields. So here you have basically this lambda tilde is promoted to a field. And also you have this T mu, which is a vector density, which you're basically adding to the theory to basically get this last term, which gives you a constraint, right? Because now if you vary with respect to T mu, you get the constraint that lambda tilde is constant. And again, this lambda tilde in this usual setting, if you just take this formulation from the literature and you import it into this kind of signature transition framework, it would tell you that it's in fact this lambda tilde, which is sort of, again, not the physical lambda, but the signature dependent lambda that is constant. So again, lambda, the physical lambda, would have to make a transition just like in the framework before. But you can, of course, generalize that. You can play with this now, right? Because the constraint is really explicitly added to the action, and you could change that, right? You could change this lambda tilde to something else, to some function of lambda and these signature parameters. And then you would get a similar scenario to what I told you before. I just wanted to advertise recent work here in which we basically put these two things together. So you can actually take the Cairo-Plibanski formalism and make it unimodular by importing the same ideas that people have used in the metric language. So in a sense, if you go back to this Plibanski action, you can see that this new here, this is a four form, which basically plays the role of a volume form. As you can see here from the simplicity constraint, the volume form of the metric will be determined by this new. okay, which of course here's a Lagrange multiplier, so it's arbitrary, but you can fix it by hand. You can put in some omega zero here that you, that is a background structure, right? And that would play the same role as this omega here. It's just some fixed volume form that breaks, of course, the symmetry group from the full diffeos down to the volume preserving diffeos. And in this setting, you can again ask, you know, is there a Bianchi identity and so on? Of course, the answer is yes. And the statement is very similar to the metric theory, which is to say that if this volume form is non-degenerate, you can look at Bianchi identities, which tell you that the trace of this matrix M has to be a constant, right? And of course, trace M previously defined for you this lambda tilde quantity, right? So you would get exactly the same statement that whenever this volume form is non-degenerate, you'd have to have a fixed cosmological constant. And then you can have this parameterized NO Teitelbaum-like version as well, where you replace this omega naught by dt, where t is a three form. And then here, of course, you see if I vary with respect to t, I get the constraint that trace M is a constant. So this again is now directly a constraint. It's not coming from a Bianchi identity. It's directly coming from variation with respect to a field. Here I see much less freedom to play with this. So here I told you that you can play with this, you can play with lambda tilde, you can do something else here that's somehow signature dependent. Here again, because I don't really know what the metric signature is, because I can't derive it directly, it's not clear whether I could generalize this or whether I'm stuck with this model where lambda is directly dependent on the signature. Okay, these are just things you can play with to generalize that discussion. One last thing I wanted to mention before I come to the end is completely different but very exciting, which is that these ideas could potentially be related to observations. So this is something that we were kind of made aware of very recently by cosmologists who actually look at data and look at cosmological tensions, which you, most of you will have heard many things about, which is sort of the fact that lambda CDM, as it's normally discussed, doesn't really seem to fit all of our different cosmological observations together with the same set of parameters. So people are very worried about this and they come up with possible alternatives. So here's one model which people have studied, which is the so-called lambda S CDM model. And in this model, as far as I understand it, you have a cosmological constant, which is constant, but then at some point had a transition where it exactly switched sign. So if you compare this with data, the best fit apparently is that this happened at redshift about 2. So in the past of our universe, lambda would have been negative, and then around redshift 2, it suddenly switched to positive. And apparently the best fit to the data, I'm told, is essentially a sudden switch. So not a slow gradual transition, but really something that just switches sign. So this, of course, looks very exciting, just on this very superficial level, in the sense that, of course, now you could say that this kind of sudden switch in the metric signature, you know, in these kind of simplest extensions of Einstein-Hilbert gravity, of course, do exactly that. They just change the sign of lambda, not the magnitude. Of course, then you'd have to explain why the metric signature would have changed at redshift equal to 2 and how you make that compatible with a kind of a degenerate metric in between. Of course, I don't know much about that, but it's certainly interesting that this kind of sign switching lambda has been looked at from a completely different perspective, which here is purely phenomenological. So let me come to the end and give you the conclusions. So the point I wanted to get across is that if you allow for this signature flip, where, you know, all the metric components change sign at the same time, this certainly gives some new possibilities for changes in lambda. So lambda doesn't have to be constant anymore, even in this very minimalist extension of Einstein-Hilbert gravity. And in fact, in a sense, the simplest scenario is the one that I kind of started the talk with, where lambda is directly signature dependent. So you just have solutions of one signature with positive lambda and negative lambda with the opposite signature. So you can see these as saddle points in quantum cosmology, but most of what I told you was completely classical, right? So you can have these classical Lorentzian formulations where these signature transitions are perfectly allowed and not singular at all. And they do connect to this switch in the sign of lambda. In the Carroll-Polbansky formalism, there's in fact no way of avoiding this. You cannot really fix the metric signature, so you would always have to have these solutions. What I find very exciting here is when you look at this in the quantum theory, only in this very simple mini superspace case, you really get a much simpler quantum theory, right? Where you can suddenly sort of integrate out things explicitly, and you have to use this kind of a squared variable of indefinite sign, which is conjugate to the connection or extrinsic curvature. And then, of course, there's this very speculative connection to phenomenology. So maybe the universe actually has flipped signature at some point in the past and therefore made lambda go from negative to positive. But that's something we really have to think about a lot more in the future. Great. So thank you for your attention.
Great. Thank you very much, Stefan. It's always not the best to have a virtual talk because you cannot hear people clapping, but I'm sure that there were people clapping virtually. So Bianca has raised hand, I think. So Bianca, please go on.
Do you want to ask students?
Oh, for sure. Of course. If there are other students, for sure. Are there students that have questions? I guess you can go on, Bianca. I don't see any student.
Thanks, Stefan, for this very nice talk. Another thing what one can do is to change the orientation.
Mm-hmm.
Where I guess it's that the lapse is negative. Can that also be easily incorporated in this framework? Is that maybe... I mean, then the cosmological constant does not change sign as far as
yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
It's just that the action becomes negative.
Yeah.
It's also something which one can do by analytical continuation or something, at least in the metric formalism. I mean, in Polbansky, it should be already automatically included.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. No, I agree with all of this. But in a sense, that possibility has already been considered by many people mm-hmm. in the literature and is much less radical in that sense, because indeed, as you say, because the metric doesn't change, the Einstein equations don't change in terms of lambda. So indeed, there would be no possibility, as far as I can see, unless you try something very exotic, to have lambda dependent on this sign of the lapse or orientation. But maybe there are ways, and I certainly haven't thought about it myself. But yeah, I would say this is something you can anyway do, but what we're proposing here is in a sense more general because you also change the metric signature.
Mm-hmm. And so maybe a technical question, because you used Kirill-Polbansky.
Mm-hmm.
Where indeed you cannot fix the signature, but if I use non-Kirill-Polbansky,
mm-hmm.
I do have an internal metric
mm-hmm.
Where I can fix the overall sign, you know, the overall sign factor. Mm-hmm. Could you say spontaneously that what you say still applies or does not apply?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's much less clear to me whether the same conclusions would apply because of what you said. So the same is true even for already standard Einstein-Cartan, where in a sense you have your tetrad already as a fundamental variable. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the metric signature is also a priori fixed.
Mm-hmm.
So then you would have to make the tetrad imaginary kind of explicitly, which seems much harder to do at the classical level.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it depends. I don't have a very definite answer to your question, but I think it depends massively on what formulation of gravity you work with, whether these things are possible or natural in some sense or very contrived.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thanks. So there is another question by Idrus. I hope I'm spelling your name right. So if you can unmute yourself.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Stefan, for the great talk. I have actually a question about whether this kind of arguments could also be applied for spherical symmetric space-time. Because as far as I remember, there's a paper a couple of years ago that a signature change could also be applied in mini-superspace of some model in loop quantum gravity. So I'm just wondering whether in this model it could be also applied for the spherical symmetric space-time.
Yeah, so I mean, so in general, I mean, okay, so of course, what most of what I told you here was in mini superspace because that's the simplest possible case, just the FRW universe, and that's the case we have looked at and studied. I mean, the arguments are really quite general, right? So if you think of the Einstein equations and you think of the correlation or the connection between the significance of lambda and the metric signature, it's a very general argument that doesn't depend on any symmetries. So if you had a scenario where in spherical symmetry you could have such a signature transition where on one side of your surface you have say minus plus 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 and the other one is plus minus minus minus, then the same logic would apply, I think, which is that naturally lambda, the physical lambda, would switch sign. Now I haven't looked at any example where that actually happens, and I don't know how easy or difficult it is to write down such an example where this happens, but I think it's certainly something that one could study and see if there are possible cases of interest. I mean, the example I showed you here is really the simplest possible thing you can write down, this DS ADS transition. So spherical symmetry would already be much harder, of course, technically. But one could certainly look at that in the context of the same framework.
But so basically it wouldn't be applied if the spacetime has some asymptotically flat properties?
I don't see why that is excluded. In principle, I mean, all you need is a splitting of your spacetime into regions where the signature is different. Right, so
right.
You could think of, so in the spherically symmetric case, you could think of, you know, some critical radius, and below that radius you have minus plus plus plus, and outside you have plus minus 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 or whatever. Of course, the question is always what happens at that surface, at the transition surface, and that's really, of course, the crucial question. So, do you have curvature singularities? Do you have coordinate singularities that you can somehow make sense of? And that's something that one would have to look at, and I certainly haven't thought about this question. But I think in principle, there's nothing that tells you that this is not a possibility in this framework. It's certainly something that could happen.
All right. Are there other questions for Stefan? If not, I have a question. In the unimodular gravity slide that you had, I'm confused about the statement of, so the root of square root g that you're writing is the full volume, right, here. So mm-hmm. This is not a subregion, right? So when you're saying that I have to send a little omega, so the volume to zero in order to switch mm-hmm. signature, should I therefore think of this as really like the universe is contracting and then re-expanding as I go through the signature? Is that the physics?
So it's a bit tricky, of course, because this also depends on the Laplace function. And of course, it's possible that... So here, I guess what you need is... So both the Laplace and the scale factor have to go to zero together, right? So, which is different from just the scale factor going to zero and the Laplace staying finite. So if the Laplace stays finite, you can say, you know, I'm measuring some proper time, whatever, and I see the scale factor going to zero, which is basically what you describe. And that solution would generally be associated with a curvature singularity in most cases. But that's not necessarily the case when you also have the Laplace, which also goes to zero at the same time. As you see, for example, in this example here with de Sitter and anti de Sitter. So here there's a metric. So the at on the coming from de Sitter, the metric scale factor is a cinch of t. So obviously that has a zero, but there's no. So there is a singularity in the foliation, I guess, in that sense that the volume of your slices goes to zero. I don't know if that helps with the question, but I think yeah, one has to look at it sort of in terms of the lapse and the scale factor.
Okay, I see.
Get a better picture.
I see. Okay. Other questions? All right, so if not, I suggest we thank Stefan again for the nice talk.
Great, thanks. Thanks for having me.